This mic. Okay. All right. The first matter on the calendar this morning is the case of, is it Houchens?
Houchens.
Nicholas Houchens versus Soo Line Railroad Company. Counsel, when you approach the podium, please identify yourselves for us. Will there be any sharing of argument of time?
No.
All right. And none there?
Correct.
Thank you. So you, appellant may proceed. Tell us who you are when you get to the podium. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Court Sylvester, and I'm proud to represent the people of Soo Line Railroad. We are the appellant in this matter. This court should reverse the judgment below because the district court introduced a fundamental bias into the trial of this matter. By limiting the extent to which Soo Line was permitted to present the full factual context surrounding Mr. Houchens' prior military-related injury that predated his service with the railroad, a disability which was declared and rated a permanent disabling injury and for which he was awarded veterans benefits. The reason why the district court's approach was so prejudicial is twofold. Not only did it accept, adopt, and reinforce Mr. Houchens' rationalization of his dishonesty about the full context surrounding his injury, it was also so important because this was a trial with conceded liability. The only issue the jury was resolving was the nature, extent, and consequences of the injury that he suffered while working for Soo Line Railroad. And the injury for which he was seeking compensation was one that was established by his own subjective reports of pain in his knees, the same part of his body that was injured in the military. Therefore, his credibility on the issue of his injury was of paramount importance, and thus...
May I... thank you. You could tell I wanted to ask a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me that there were really two issues with regard to the knees. The Veterans Administration awarding a 10% disability benefit with respect to each knee, and the actual condition of the respondent's knees. Doesn't the record reflect that there was cross-examination with respect to the medical records relating to the respondent's knees?
Yes, Soo Line was permitted partially to explore the issue of the injury that was treated and for which he was awarded veterans benefits. And that is the distinction on which the trial court rested its resolution of this issue, was this supposed distinction between the VA's observation of the extent of impairment of mobility of his knee versus the disability rating that it assigned him. And that's what I was referring to when I said that the district court's approach essentially adopted Mr. Houchens' rationalization of his claims, that there was some distinction between the sore knees that he had coming out of the military versus an actual injury. What's important is...
Who makes a disability rating determination? You wanted to get two things in. It seems to me I would actually separate, although they're related, the disability rating and then the money received as a result of it.
Correct.
You wanted both things in.
Correct.
Who makes a determination about the rating?
Well,
because you're saying that the medical records only reflect his point of view, but
what's the
missing point of view about it?
The portion of cross-examination or the portion of the evidence that Soo Line was allowed to introduce at trial only addressed the issue of what the district court referred to as the limitation on flexion of the knee, the 10% limitation. The district court attempted to draw the distinction between that and the fact that it was a disability rating that was being assigned. And,
I understand that. I'm wondering whose perspective, if you're saying that the medical records reflected essentially only his perception of his injury and that the Supreme Court, District Court adopted that by limiting it, I'm wondering whose perspective was missing then about the extent of the injury? Like, what does it mean to say the VA's perspective is missing?
Well, the Suline was allowed to put in portions of both physician's testimony and the VA documentation regarding their assessment of Mr. Houchin's condition that referred to what the district court characterized as the limitation on function of the knee. The district court excluded any mention of, for instance, rating. So it did not, the portions of the record that were presented to the jury didn't mention that this was a permanent disability rating that the VA had assigned Mr. Houchins. It didn't mention
Right, and that rating, it's not in the record maybe as to who makes that rating decision.
Correct. And our point is that this limitation on impeachment of Mr. Houchins and on establishing the full context surrounding his military injury and the consequences therefrom created a fundamental bias in the trial when the core issue was not only the nature of his injury, but the credibility of his declarations, pronouncements to both Suline and his doctors, et cetera. And so the district court should not have essentially bought into Mr. Houchin's attempts to square his statements to Suline and his doctors and reinforced that for the jury. For instance, one of the key avenues of impeachment that Suline attempted to introduce was these employment forms that Mr. Houchins filled out both before and during his time on the railroad. And eventually, there were two questions on those forms which Suline attempted to introduce to show that Mr. Houchins had not been entirely honest with his employer. One was a question about, do you have any prior injury, essentially? And the other was, are you receiving benefits for any prior disability? And eventually, the district court came around to the point of view that Mr. Houchins, by denying that he had had a specific injury to his knee, had opened the door, and it did allow the answer to the denial of a prior injury on those forms to come in. But it did not allow the answer that, no, I am not receiving benefits for any prior injury. And that created this sort of imbalance in terms of squaring the factual context for the jury. Essentially, Mr. Houchins fuzzed up the question of whether he had an injury. Oh, I just had sore knees when I came out of the military. That wasn't a specific injury. He could make it look as if that was merely a matter of interpretation on that question. But on that first question, there's no way to square the actual facts that he was, in fact, receiving benefits because the Veterans Administration had identified a permanent disability with his answer on those forms. And that's what Suline should have been allowed to get into in addressing this issue with the jury.
But you're much more familiar with this record than I am, so I just want to make sure I understand, because I was troubled by the employment records issue as well, but didn't Suline introduce those employment records? I mean, so my question is, if the jury was left with the impression that he wasn't receiving military benefits, wasn't it your client that introduced them?
The court required that the answer denying receipt of benefits be redacted from those records. So as originally presented to cross-examine Mr. Houchins, both of those answers were redacted. And then when the court later determined that he had opened the door on whether he had an injury, that second one, do you have a prior injury, that was allowed to come in, but it maintained its ruling that the question about receiving benefits must be redacted. And the trial court's
So just when we're looking at that, because I'm looking at Addendum 46 as an example of one of these. So there, and we don't see it in the redacted form, right?
Correct.
And so there are three bullet points. The first one is, have you ever received compensation? That was redacted.
Correct.
Because these were actually introduced as exhibits, I take it?
Correct.
Okay. And that never became unredacted. Okay, but the second question of, do you have any limitation, or excuse me, do you have any medical disorder or physical impairment? Is that the question that eventually was permitted, okay, to be seen by the jury? And unquestionably, right, the first question, had that been answered truthfully, would not come in because collateral source compensation shouldn't come in because it tends to have a prejudicial effect, right? I mean, there's a reason for that.
That was the district court's ruling, yes. And that
and it's only because you want to introduce it to show dishonesty on the question of compensation. Received?
Well, there are three reasons, essentially, why Suline believes the collateral source rule does not exclude that portion of the record. It is, for one, it is impeachment, which is not, contrary to Mr. Houchin's claims, limited solely to a denial that he received the benefits. It is entirely possible under the prevailing law to introduce the fact of payments as impeachment, even when there has not been a stark denial of those benefits. The second reason is to prove the nature and extent of a prior injury. That is the Kelsey decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court, which says that you can introduce collateral source evidence, despite the collateral source rule, to prove a prior injury. And the third reason is the what's been referred to as the pleading poverty exception. So when a plaintiff tells the jury that they are under financial distress as a result of the injury, the fact of receiving benefits can come in. This is the exception which Mr. Houchins suggests is limited in FELA cases to instances in which, for instance, he claims emotional distress as a result of the financial hardship imposed by the injury, which is not, in fact, the only circumstances under which collateral source evidence can come in. And in addition, I would note, although I don't believe this is stressed in the briefs, Mr. Houchins actually did testify to having an emotional reaction that would form the predicate for even his version of that exception to this rule. At one point, Mr. Houchin's counsel asked him how he felt. The point being here that some redirect examination to underscore the point that Suline was calling him a liar, and Mr. Houchins was asked, how does that make you feel? But the question he was asked was, how do you feel about losing your job and having these accusations made about your honesty? And Mr. Houchin said, well, I have extreme anxiety about that.
Is there a case, even if your argument is that it could have come in, is there a case where an appellate court, either federal or Minnesota, reversed a decision not to let this information in?
I don't believe there are any Minnesota cases cited in the briefs on that. And it is a matter of discretion. There is no question that the case law recognizes that the trial court has discretion on the issue, but it's a discretion that must involve weighing not only the alleged prejudice, but also the probative value and the need. So I can't point you to a specific case that reverses a trial court's exclusion of this evidence in an analogous factual context. But I would point out that the case law which is most critical to Mr. Houchin's assessment of this issue doesn't impose the absolute prohibition which the district court based its excess of caution on this issue on. For instance, the core foundation for the Mr. Houchin's position is the U.S. Supreme Court's Eichel decision, which is characterized in the briefing as establishing an absolute prohibition on collateral source evidence in FELA cases. In fact, Eichel was a five-paragraph opinion that did not discuss situations in which a plaintiff has opened the door. In fact, Eichel actually recognizes that a court could have discretion to admit collateral source evidence in a FILA case. What the Eichel decision discussed was that it used prior to the adoption of Federal Rule of Evidence 403, it used the Rule 403 language of weighing the prejudice against the need, thereby recognizing a trial court's discretion to admit the collateral source evidence in some cases, in FILA cases. And similarly, the Moses case, which is the Eighth Circuit decision that Mr. Houchins relies upon to suggest that there are only two limited exceptions in FILA cases, Moses actually recognized that there may in fact be other situations in which a court could have that discretion. In that case, the defense justified its attempt to cross-examine the witness about collateral source evidence on the basis that it would establish the witness's motive or interest in dishonesty. And it said, well, that it wasn't necessary to go that far on the cross to prove that point, so we're not going to let you get into the collateral source evidence, which implies that if it had been necessary, that would have been a legitimate basis in that instance. So for all of those reasons, and as my time is up, I'm not going to address the second basis for our appeal unless the court has any questions about that, but I'll reserve that opportunity for rebuttal if necessary.
And you'll be offered that opportunity.
Thank you.
Responder.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Fred Bremseth, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff, Mr. Nicholas Houchins. Back in 1963, the United States Supreme Court ruled in the Eichel versus New York Central Railroad case. For the last 50 years, that has been black letter law with respect to this collateral source issue. Routinely in the FELA world, in FELA cases, that motion in limine is made pretrial, and it's routinely granted based on Eichel. Eichel has been adopted and interpreted and affirmed by, I think, almost every circuit court. There are, as I said in my brief, I think about four or five circuit courts that hold the rule ironclad, that they take Eichel as the United States Supreme Court doing the 403 balancing test with respect to collateral source issues.
Tell me what it means. What does Eichel mean? You say, I mean, you acknowledge your exceptions to it, right? And you're just talking about a balancing test. I'm wondering what Eichel means and how it compares to Minnesota's general collateral source rule. I think your briefs are different, but I'm wondering why.
Right. It's very common, in railroad cases for an injured railroad worker to have perhaps Railroad Retirement Board benefits, VA benefits, maybe some disability insurance policies that he's paid for. In almost every case, the railroad defense will try to attack the credibility of the railroad worker. You're lying. You're not hurt as bad as you say you're hurt. The injury really didn't happen the way that you said it. You're malingering. You just want a big day in court. That case went to the Supreme Court in Eichel, and Eichel said the receipt of those collateral source benefits is just too powerful. It's just too prejudicial for the injured worker, and the risk that the railroad jury, that the jury will conclude we're not going to give him as much money because he's already getting some other money, is just too powerful. And in Eichel, as well as in Moses and the other circuit courts, the courts have said there are all kinds of less prejudicial ways for the defendant to attack the worker's credibility. And so that has been the black letter law.
Are you saying there are no exceptions to it?
Well, several of the circuit courts, as I pointed out in my brief, say that. In the Eighth Circuit, in the Moses case, they carved out two exceptions.
And what about the exception for emotional injury? When the respondent testified that he had great anxiety about having lost his job and having his character attacked, wasn't he raising that issue of emotional injury?
I would say no, he was not. Full reading of the record indicates that the testimony did not rise to the level as in the Moses example. There were cases in Moses and in some of the other cases where terrific emotional testimony was given by a spouse, for example, talking about extreme emotional distress, plaintiffs claiming that they were financially destitute and that they had grave emotional distress. This case did not rise to that level at all in terms of what Mr. Houchin said. And this was a matter that was carefully considered by the trial judge, and he exercised his discretion appropriately and did not allow that. And I think it's important, since I'm thinking about it, that, of course, this is an abuse of discretion standard. And I think the record reflects that the trial judge did a very fine job of listening to the lawyers, listening to the discussions, considering the evidence, and making discretionary rulings. The only two exceptions in Moses would be, one, if the plaintiff brings it up himself and talks about it, well, then, of course, it's in the record. And number two, if the plaintiff cries destitution.
Or claims emotional injury.
Well, severe emotional injury as a result of destitution.
Right. That's right. One of the exceptions listed in Moses.
Yes, but the base of it really, I think, in fairness, is that it is severe emotional distress from being financially destitute.
Well, yeah, I'm not arguing with you about that. It's just that is one of the exceptions in Moses.
Moses lays out that as a potential exception. That's true. We are bound, as the court is aware, in the Kinworthy case. This is a federal substantive issue, not a state issue. And I wanted to get, if I could, you know, the trial court allowed all of the medical records and allowed vigorous cross-examination of anything with respect to pre-existing injuries. The record is clear on that. It's important for us to note for the record that in final argument, when all was said and done, the defendant admitted causation in this case. They didn't just admit that they were negligent when they backed the truck into Mr. Houchin's. They admitted that they caused him injury and damages. So all of this discussion about pre-existing injuries and what the medical records in the VA showed or didn't show really melted away. In final argument, counsel said, we admit that you should answer question number two, yes, we did cause him injury or damages.
The case, as appellant's counsel has indicated, was about the extent of the damages.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, in many personal injury cases, the question does arise about pre-existing condition or pre-existing injury. So that would go to the extent of damages for which Sue Line would be liable.
True. And they were fully and completely allowed to cross-examine on all of the medical issues. And in fact, they had Dr. Wired as their defense medical expert.
And I see that Dr. Wired got into the evidence through his testimony that he thought there was a social responsibility to doing these adverse examinations, I trust, and in his opinion, when someone has consistently been taking money from the federal government, and the court interrupted him and instructed the jury to disregard the answer, but obviously the jury knew there was something up about government money being received by the plaintiff.
Dr. Wired, despite the motion in limine ruling, blurted out that the plaintiff, Mr. Houchins, was receiving federal funds for his military issues. The quote is, he's taking money from the federal government for military issues.
I don't think that actually didn't make it into the transcript, the last part of that. So perhaps the jury heard something not reflected in the record, but the gist of it is here.
Yeah, and so even though it wasn't supposed to get in front of the jury, it got in front of the jury anyway.
Let me ask you this about the knees.
Were there any medical records in existence that indicated that on a certain date at a certain time an injury occurred while the respondent was serving his tours of duty in Iraq, that he tore a meniscus or tore a ligament? Was there any record that indicated an injury like that other than the general soreness that he complained about to the VA and the obvious pain?
No. The entire VA chart talked about this man had done two tours in Iraq, and he had sore joints, not just the knees. He had sore shoulders. He had sore back. He had sore hips. He had sore feet. And the military, when he was discharged in 2006, you can see in the form there where they talked about sore joints, sore hips, sore knees. There was no evidence ever at all about any specific injury. I was going to indicate, again, with respect to Dr. Wired, I mean, they had, if they wanted to, they had ample opportunity for Dr. Wired to try to make a determination about pre-existing and how much was before and how much was after. They forego that. They did not follow that. And instead, Dr. Wired came in and said, this man has no injuries at all. Everything's normal. He's faking. He's lying. So that was their choice. But if they wanted to get back to the point Your Honor had asked a moment ago about pre-existing, they could have done that. And then in final argument, they said, okay, we admit we caused him some injuries or damages. You can mark that box, yes. And so truly, this was a damages-only case. And just to get to that point, there was clearly ample evidence. This verdict is in line with other verdicts that the court has seen, Larson, Albany. There was ample evidence with respect to the fact that he had lost his career with the railroad. And quite frankly, those facts weren't contested. Their witnesses indicated that they would not accommodate him. All he needed was to wear knee braces to go back. And they said, we will not take you back. It was not a contested fact. They admitted it. They admitted that they could not transfer his seniority. So he had lost all job security and all job seniority. They admitted that they would not take him back in a seniority-based position. And they admitted that the job that they gave him as a litigation, pre-litigation job just weeks before trial was temporary. And they can fire him anytime, they can let him go at any time, and all of that was basically admitted and not really controversial.
Is it the damages question was just one question on the verdict form, and the brief seemed to focus a lot on earning power. Is it, but the jury was also instructed on pain and mental and emotional suffering. Is it possible that part of the $2 million goes to that?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Okay, there was nothing in the trial that excluded that somehow.
Nothing,
okay.
No. That was, in a FELA case like this, your essential damages are your past wage loss claim, your loss of future earning capacity, and general damages for pain and suffering.
Would you briefly address the checking no on the box in the employment records that he did not receive military benefits and how the court handled that from your perspective? I mean, you know, looking at that kind of from an impeachment lens, that would, you know, typically strike me as something that would be admissible.
Yes. Well, as a general rule, I would say that that's basically what EICHL was all about. You know, if you want to impeach somebody, you want to attack their character or their honesty, there are all kinds of ways to do it without getting into collateral source benefits. So we start from that premise. I would like to draw the court's attention, however, to page 44 and 45 and the appendix. And in fact, the question was answered yes on that first form. So to get to Your Honor's question earlier, you know, on, for example, page 44, the question was asked, you know, and it's yes. Now, there was no witness to get into VA decision-making processes or procedures. We have no idea what a 10% rating means or how they would arrive at a couple hundred bucks a month for each knee. So none of that was developed. I suppose it could have been if they had really wanted to. But the fact that there's a word that he's getting some compensation for disability doesn't mean that he was disabled. And in fact, he wasn't disabled. He worked for 7 years for this railroad with no problems, full duty, climbing up and down ladders, doing all of the duties.
But ICA wasn't about someone being dishonest about their receipt of medical or of benefits. And in two forms, there was a yes, but the reason was sleep, which doesn't seem to fully capture what the basis of the benefits were for. And then the last one, the answer was no. I mean, clearly that no answer is wrong, right?
Well,
have you ever received compensation for a disability or other disability?
Disability. So Mr. Houchins never considered himself disabled, and to this day did not consider himself disabled. And when he filled out this form, he didn't consider himself disabled.
Even though he did the previous year. They're inconsistent answers. I don't know what changed relative to that.
They are inconsistent answers in that sense. The railroad, this is a little outside, but as you're aware of, the railroad and their workers are covered by the Railway Labor Act. There is a collective bargaining agreement between the workers and the company, and the railroad has, under the Railway Labor Act, full abilities to discipline, call investigations, and fire people if they think he's dishonest. That has never happened. So that is a separate procedure, it's a separate law, it's a separate forum. And in this case, the railroad, I would venture to say that their defense in this case was a little schizophrenic in the sense that on the one hand, the lawyers came into court and tried to call him a liar and dishonest, but the management people thought he was a wonderful worker, a great worker, and put him into a job of some very great importance, training new hires. On the one hand, they said that he had all these injuries in the military, but in court, their doctor said he didn't have any injuries at all.
My time is up.
So I think that in conclusion, the trial court exercised its discretion properly, and there's been no showing of any abuse of discretion, and this court should affirm the verdict. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to ensure that the record is complete, the testimony to which I was referring in the original portion of my argument, in which Mr. Houchins represented his extreme anxiety as a result of losing his job and also having his honesty questioned, was on page 401 of the trial transcript, the third day of trial. So just so that is in the record. Since I'm not certain that it was referred to in the briefs. Mr. Bremseth's description of the cross-examination at trial and the nature of the evidence that the jury was presented is accurate up to a point. What's important to remember is that although Suline was allowed to ask Mr. Houchins some questions about whether he was injured and was allowed to ask Mr. Houchins about part of his answers on those employment forms, Mr. Houchins consistently on the stand represented to the jury that he was not injured. That's why the trial court eventually allowed some of the impeachment that Suline sought, but it didn't allow the jury to learn the full context surrounding his military injury and how it was handled by the Veterans Administration. Mr. Bremseth argues that Suline admitted causation, which frankly is not really relevant to the issue at hand here. Frankly, under the FELA statute, there was almost no choice but to admit causation, and it's always been conceded that Suline admitted that one of its employees backed into Mr. Houchins with a vehicle. The issue, however, for the jury to resolve was the nature, extent, and continuing consequences of the railroad injury in particular, and it was that context that all of what we have discussed today is relevant. The Veterans Administration identified, even if it didn't pinpoint where and when in Iraq this arose, it identified that Mr. Houchins had patellofemoral syndrome, a defined injury, and it assigned a disability rating to both knees for that injury and eventually awarded veterans benefits. I don't really see how it answers Sue Line's concerns with the limitation on impeachment in this action that Mr. Houchins admitted receiving benefits once because he then turned around and denied it on subsequent forms. The important thing to remember is that his credibility was crucially important to this trial. It was a trial about whether or not his representations about his injury were credible. And that was what Sue Line was attempting to test by attempting to admit all of the evidence surrounding the VA's treatment of his military injury. The full medical records from the VA came in because Mr. Houchins stipulated to their admission, and that's why there was no VA witness who could explain those procedures. But then Mr. Houchins turned around and sought to exclude portions of what was contained in there, specifically the fact of the permanent disability rating and then the subsequent receipt of benefits. Mr. Houchins may not have considered himself to be disabled when he filled out these forms, but that was not the question the forms asked him. The forms asked Mr. Houchins whether he received benefits for a prior service-related injury or other employment injury, and he was receiving checks. For a disability, yeah. Correct. And he received checks. He accepted those checks. So whether he considered himself disabled or not, the only correct answer to those questions was no. And limiting Sue Line to only putting in part of what it considered dishonest on those representations in the forms kept it from being able to adequately test, to tip the balance in its favor consistent with the facts on this question of Mr. Houchins' credibility. For all of those reasons, the trial court's resolution of this issue introduced a fundamental bias that requires that the judgment below be reversed.
Thank you. Before you leave, will you please identify for me the two other lawyers at counsel table?
The other lawyer at table for Sue Line is Catherine Short.
Thank you.
And for Mr. Hodgins, it's David Stern.
Thank you very much. All right, the matter has been well argued. It is taken under advisement, and an opinion will be forthcoming.